Welcome back, WNST Towson Baltimore and WNST.net. We're going to have a little departure here from the usual sports conversation. Many of you may or may not know that back in the 1980s, I was the music critic for the Baltimore Sun for about 7 years and interviewed many, many rock stars, a couple hundred interviews, and I have all of them on little mini micro cassettes that I've digitized when my wife was ill battling cancer back in October, November. I took a couple of months and just put it all into digital format. And on Monday morning, I woke up and literally over my cup of coffee, the first thing I saw after all the football was that David Bowie died on Monday morning or into the night on Sunday night. And back in 1991, I interviewed David Bowie. First off, I'm a huge David Bowie fan. I probably saw him perform a dozen times through the years. I actually found a review where I had panned his Sound and Vision tour at Meriwether Post Pavilion in 1990. And in 1991, he was on the road with a heavy metal band. I mean, not heavy metal, but very, very hard rock, sort of German, you know, not Motorhead, but on the road to Motorhead. A band called Tin Machine. You may not remember it. They had a song called Under the God, and this was, you know, long after Modern Love and Let's Dance and Ziggy Stardust and Suffragette City and Rebel Rebel and all that good stuff, and I think it's good stuff. You can go back and listen to Tin Machine. They made a couple of albums, but this interview was to promote a show at a really rare venue called the Citadel Center, which was an old roller rink in Adams Morgan in D.C. It was kind of a shady area, to be really honest with you. I remember being a little bit threatening that neighborhood back in 1991, but in November of 1991, David Bowie called me, Collect, by the way, and we chatted for 20 minutes, and I got to be honest, I've never, ever gone back and listened to any of these interviews. I recorded them. I'm almost embarrassed by them. It was before I was on the radio. I was very jumpy, very young. I was 22 years old when this interview happened. I may have just turned 23, so I was 23 years old when this interview happened, and it happened a few months before I left the Sun and started my radio career. The story appeared in the Baltimore Sun on November 14th of 1991. My first day on the radio was December 13th of 1991, which was a month after Memorial Stadium was closed down in October of 1991 as well. And then, of course, in 92, they began playing at Camden Yards, and my radio career began. So this is literally 25 years ago, 24 and a half years ago. David Bowie called, and I chatted with him, and I got to be honest, there's so much in this that was better than I thought it would be. I am a little embarrassed. I'm a little red-faced anytime I go back and listen to this stuff. It's kind of like looking at old pictures of yourself, but this was a 23-year-old version of me talking to David Bowie, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed finding it and listening to it, and RIP to David Bowie, who was a beautiful man. I wound up, the night that I met him, I wound up being invited out for a drink, and we had some appetizers in a little cafe in Adams Morgan, and I actually had a chance to chat with him more. He was such an artist. He liked to talk, as you'll hear in this, and I, you know, for me being jumpy and can't get a word in edgewise, I'm a little embarrassed by my tone in it, but I think you'll appreciate it for what it was, and I think I certainly appreciate it, and it's something fun for my son to listen to. So I hope you appreciate this. It's David Bowie, Tin Machine, November 1991, and this is what it sounded like in all of my embarrassment.
Can you take a collect call from David Bowie in the United Kingdom?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, is that Nestor?
This is Nestor.
How are you?
Great, how are you?
I'm very well indeed.
How is your tour coming along?
Absolutely sublime, I think is the word.
Well,
the word, I don't know. I'll have to ask Reeves Cabrels. He's the only one here that speaks the Queen's English.
What do you speak, indeed?
I'm speaking Englishese.
Englishese, oh, okay. What kind of venues are you playing over there?
Everything ranging between 1,500 and 4,000. So they tend from the large club to the tiny arena.
So you're filling these things up pretty well?
It's a sold-out tour.
Okay, great, great. Now, why didn't you choose to play larger places there as well as here?
Because I don't think that this band is well-known enough to do that.
So you're not ready to ride on your reputation at all?
Not one bit, no. No, I think we're, you know, almost precious about the band in that way.
Right.
That we wanted to grow at its own speed.
Now, how many fans do you think are coming out specifically? specifically to see you, or how many?
Well, we've been judging by who knows the songs.
Right, exactly.
For the first couple of dates in Milano, in Italy, it was sort of like nodding heads on the first couple of rows and mouthing the words. But now that's worked its way backwards because we've developed a knot of fans now. I've got their own vans and things and sleepers and have been coming around Europe with us. And now we're up to about 13 rows. I don't know if they stop at the water. I don't know if they come over to America. But it might mean we start all over again as of Philadelphia.
Great. When did this whole thing come together? Now, I know, you know, the album was out about 2.5 years ago, and we got Tin Machine 1.
That was probably the real start point, was when Reeves and I were working on a thing for ICA. Thank you, Reeves. Institute of Contemporary Arts. You see what I mean? Back in 89, and what's that? What do I mean, Reese is asking? Oh, see what I mean? please don't try and follow any of this. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Is there a certain camaraderie that goes along with being in a rock and roll band?
God, we can't stand each other. No, camaraderie my ass. What?
Get out of my room.
Room. Basically. See, I am using his room. I only make my international phone calls from his room.
Right. But I'm paying the bill anyway.
But that gives me the chance to say David Bowie to the operator. She says, yeah, sure you are, and I'm the Queen of England.
Right, right. Well, I'm sure there's
which I usually reply, that makes two of us. But I'm Bob. What were we talking about, Nessa?
I think we were talking about camaraderie inside a rock and roll band.
Absolutely none. Zilch. We try and avoid each other at every possible step of the way, even on stage.
But I mean,
especially musically.
But putting this whole thing together, was the whole impetus to be in a rock and roll band for you?
No, it wasn't. I mean, Reeves and I had a particular thing going that we liked very much musically. It was quite exciting, the stuff that we did for the... what is it? Institute of Contemporary Arts. It was a backing piece of music for the dance troupe La La La, Human Steps La La La. Because sort of the Edward Locke is a friend of mine, and we really wanted to have the chance to work together. I brought in Reeves to do that, and out of that evolved the idea of getting a couple of other guys and starting to put some more sort of extreme, experimentally kind of things together. And it came about that it ended up being Hunt and Tony, who I'd worked with in the past, so it was sort of, there was some rapport between us all.
Great, but...
Well, he's not with Reeves, of course, because we've never met them, but... And it just evolved in the studio over the first week that it became quite obvious that we were definitely a band. And did we want to stay together, really? So it was really, the whole thing was an experiment that unwittingly put ourselves into a band situation.
But you never consciously went into this thing thinking, I want a band?
No, I've never done that with anything I've done. I mean, but most of the best things I've ever done were sort of, you know, happy accidents, as Reese would say.
Right.
It sort of stumbled into situations, and they turn out to be quite glorious.
Is it kind of nice to be in your position that you're in, where you're very well known, and you can just not have to think too much about the future? You can sort of go day to day and month to month.
Everything with this lot. Are you kidding me? I've got more pressure on me now than I ever had as a solo artist.
Why do you think that is?
I'm just doing this to make Reeves angry. Can I quote you? What are you going to say? He said bullshit. So there you are.
I don't even have to interview him now.
I've had my comeuppance. That's my comeuppance for the day. We haven't played yet tonight. We're playing in a couple of hours.
Do you really feel pressure, though?
No, the only pressures that we have are the pressure of night to night, the actual playing itself, but it's the most pleasant kind of pressure. You know, you just want to do the best that you possibly can. But it's being done in such a simplistic fashion that we're not putting the usual kinds of, you know, mega pressures that you usually get in touring or rock situations. You know, I mean, there's no show to think about per se. You know,
but I mean, you've had success at every level. Now, I mean, how much pressure is there to make this thing work on a certain level?
That's the thing. It's, you see, for us, that's our whole premise has been, and it's what we sort of live for within the band, that we are a success. I mean, the fact that we've got the albums done and we're playing our music, that's the success we were looking for.
Right. Now, how is the British crowd different from the United States crowd?
I don't know yet. I mean, we've never done this. We just did two gigs in the States. That's all we've ever done.
Now, what gigs were they?
They were a couple of years ago now on a promotional thing that we did. Right. We did the Roxy in Los Angeles.
Right.
We did the World on Avenue A, I think it is, in New York.
Right. Why didn't this thing get going a lot quicker? Why did you go and do the Sound and Vision, or did you feel a certain need to do that?
Yeah, I needed to do it, one, because I wanted the money, and two, to stop doing these songs. It seemed a good way of really sort of tidying up that part of my life. You know, I had no intention of carrying on parodying my own songs, but which is what it ends up being when you sort of, you know, been doing a song for 20 years. You can't imbue it with any more enthusiasm. I mean, I don't care who you are, it's very hard to really get a committed feel to a song when you've done it so many times that you get to a point where you don't like singing the song anymore.
Right. Is that why you...
Yeah, I don't think you can kid people for very long that you are enjoying yourself. So what you end up doing is doing that the shows get bigger and bigger and bigger because you don't... All you are keen on doing is sort of making as much revenue as possible instead of having musically an interesting life. And I wasn't going to get into that position.
So you've sold those songs for the last time now?
Yes.
Is that kind of why you reworked them in several ways? So you were kind of bored with them before?
Yeah, I think one inevitably does that. And also, I had great trust in Adrian and his, you know, perception of my music. And I said, well, look, Adrian, it's your band. How would you play them? And I'll sing them. You call it, and I'll sing it, you know?
See, I didn't realize it worked that way. I had interviewed Adrian, but
yeah.
He didn't tell me he had as much artistic control.
I had carte blanche on how he wanted to do it. And the majority of the time, I must say, he wanted to stick with the original arrangements. But obviously, he made things different if they suited his band style of playing.
I was just interested in why there was no saxophone in Blue Jean and Young Americans.
Wait until you come and see this lot. You'll get so much saxophone you wish you'd never asked.
Now, what kind of, how many instruments are you playing here?
I'm playing saxophone, guitar, keyboards, tuba, violin, no.
Cello.
Yes, of course.
And third trumpet, right?
Not to mention the cello. I told you not to mention the cello. Just saxophone and alto, baritone, sax, and guitar.
Now, does that stimulate you to play those instruments because you've never really had a chance as a frontman?
Yeah, that's right. It's the only band situation that I've been in where I can really sort of, you know, just kind of, you know, screw about with the saxophone.
I don't think anybody's even seen you pick a guitar up lately.
No, right. I mean, I'm thrilled with that side of it. You know, it's a lot of... And on stage, I mean, the whole thing gets very experimental and spontaneous. I mean, it's not the most comfortable band in the world to watch because it really sort of takes some chances musically.
Right.
And I guess if you, you know... If you're looking for a dance band, we ain't it.
Right. Well, I mean, with all the talented people you've worked with Alomar and Blue and these people,
yeah.
Why not them? Why this group that you put together now?
Well, the first...
Or is Reeves around and you can't answer that honestly?
No, I can answer that, actually. I'm after the end of the show, we're never, ever going to work together again. Because, frankly, I think his playing leaves a lot to be desired. But on the other hand, the reason that we've got Reeves in this band is that both Carlos Alomar wasn't available. that was a decision from the bathroom. Okay.
You're nasty.
I mean, well, the thing is, one wants to move on, you know. I mean, it's nice to work with guys once or twice, you know. And I work with Adrian, and I do go back and work with people, you know. I mean, Alomar, I work with him sometime, and then around the early 80s, we stopped working together. And then I worked with him again during the middle 80s. And Adrian, I worked with him the first time in 78 and 79. Through that period, and then I worked with him again, you know, for the last year or so. And Ronson, for instance, generally on all the tours that we do, he always plays Canada with us because he lives out. He was up until a short while ago living up in Canada.
Right.
And would always come and join the last couple of gigs and play and jam on those things. So one, you know, you do it, it's kind of, you go back to people again for different kinds of music and different kinds of feels and things.
Right. So give me the story about how you and Reeves met again. Now Sarah was a publicist, is that correct?
That's right. Sarah's a,
well, was she your publicist? Because I've talked to her before. I know that name.
She actually is a hard news journalist.
Really?
I mean, she worked for the Science Monitor, you know, for many years.
Okay, but was she a publicist, though?
And then she worked for another Boston paper. I'll have to wait until Reeves has finished talking, but I'll find out. He's talking to somebody.
Oh.
Ooh. And what happened is that my PR fell ill on one of my tours, on the last tour, and Sarah stepped in. She said, well, because she knew a mutual friend of mine, both being Christian Scientists, and Sarah came onto the tour and acted as PR for about 3 or 4 weeks to help us out, because she kind of knew the ropes, you know. And she said, and Reeves would come along on occasionally, you know, come to the gigs, and we'd sit around. And frankly, the last thing we ever talked about was music. We talked with sort of painters.
And that was Glass Spider, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And both Reeves and I went through art school and all that, you know. So we chatted a lot about art and, you know, a lot of concepts.
Right.
Just kind of
kind of what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, we could throw a few names in, you know. A few Rauschenbergs and Julian Schnabel. How much we both detested Julian Schnabel, and isn't this a shame nobody can paint anymore today?
Actually, when you're in D.C., there's a Monet exhibit here in Baltimore.
Oh, I know. I've been reading my books to find out what's actually happening at the moment. There's some quite exciting things.
Yeah, but when you're in, you ought to take a look at that. But anyway,
and it's Philadelphia. It's the Duchamp, of course, in the.
When you live in Baltimore, you're on your own little island. You don't find out what's happening in the rest of the world. So, is it kind of strange for you not to be viewed in the light of the hard rock thing? Because you've never really done anything this to the right, so to speak.
No, that's true. I mean, the nearest I've got to it, I guess, was the there were shades of this kind of feel on both Scary Monsters and Heroes, I guess. Those two albums had some aspects of the kind of atmosphere that we produce with this band. But this is truly, I mean, it has its own place, definitely.
But what really...
It's very exciting to be in.
But what really made you go in this direction as far as...
I think it's because it's music that we all missed hearing on radio. I mean, and as Reeves quite rightly pointed out, and still do.
are you kind of angered that this that
we found it? No, frankly, we kind of expected it, you know, because I mean, we knew we weren't making puff pastries here.
Right.
And it's not music for getting up and having breakfast to, by any means.
Right.
Now, I think though, but we kind of assumed that. As what we like doing best is playing live, because it becomes so improvisational that what we're going to be doing really is picking up a word of mouth type following, which is indeed what exactly is happening in Europe here.
Is it a different show every single night? Or
yeah, there is no set list at all, and songs will manipulate themselves as usually at Hunt Sales' whim. Hunt Sales tells us where we're going, then we jump on.
Okay. Where did the writing responsibility for this band fall?
And Reeves adds, and Hunt will also dictate how fast we get there.
That's the job of the rhythm section, isn't it?
That certainly is.
Who did the responsibility of the writing fall on in the band?
I think pretty much on the first album, it was much between Reeves and I. There was some occasional collaboration from the other two guys. But on this last album, it's very much a fully collaborative effort. I mean, there's quite a few tracks in there that all four of us actually wrote, and there's some where that are split up between myself and Hunt. Others where there are three of us, or, you know, I mean, it's various combinations. And it's just because we're feeling so much more at ease with each other. We're sort of, you know, really wanting to all put into the pot, so to speak.
Right, right. Now, the album cover design, let's just go through the songs first off. With Betty Wrong, what in the world was going on when you wrote that song?
I think it was there was something quirky about the. I mean, it was a really strange series of chord changes that Reeves developed, and the song that I started, the melody line that I started writing over the top of it, had shades of kind of Kurt Weill kind of thing. There was a Brechtian Weill kind of feel to the tune. It was very Germanic in that sort of early, late 20s, early 30s kind of style. And I needed a set of images that went with that kind of angst-ridden kind of melody. So it kind of evolved out of that. I can't remember where the title... I guess somebody said, well, it ain't... It's not a Betty Wright song? Is that it? Reeves? Can you remember why it's called Betty Wrong? I wanted to call it Tom Betty, but nobody would buy that.
Well, were there religious...
Hold on, Reeves is explaining to me why I wrote it. Oh, that's right, yes. Reese was explaining to Hunt the kind of groove it should probably have. And Hunt said, oh, yeah, you mean like a Betty Wright kind of thing. And Reese, being terminally clever, said, no.
Wrote it down on the
tape reel as Betty Wrong.
Betty Wrong.
I could remember which piece of music it was.
So it just stuck. So it's a piece of irony, then.
It's a piece of irony, suggests our kindly journalist.
The irony is not lost
on him.
But anyway, are there religious undertones in the wording?
I think so. I think that that couldn't help that happen. I think spiritual, not religious. I don't think anybody in this band is religious, but I think everybody in this band has a certain degree of spirituality.
I mean, you don't touch on that very often in your songs.
No, it occasionally comes up. I think one of the first times I felt very strongly pushed by my search for spirituality was something like Words on the Wing on the Station to Station album. And I've touched only occasionally on it, but it's certainly something that it's not foreign to me, that particular drive.
How often do you think about these?
Vacuum of spiritual life.
How often do you think about these kinds of things?
Very much. Daily.
And daily. Does this sort of bother you, and this song sort of shows it, or?
No, in fact, it's quite the reverse. Probably at that time, I think probably the last couple of years, I've become more committed to my feelings of assuredness of where I fall spiritually. So today, in fact, I feel quite self-assured that I feel very committed to the idea of God and my place in any plan of His. But not at a Christian level. It's very hard for me to explain it, I think. Well, I think if I just say that I'm not a religious person, but I'm a spiritual person, that should probably sum it up.
I think Bono said that once.
I'm sorry?
I think Bono said that once. You stole his quote. I know you did.
Oh, dear.
But
it's probably Buddhist first.
That's a European attitude. When you sit down to write, is there a certain mindset that changes from Ziggy Stardust to David Bowie to Tin Machine?
Wait, excuse me, did you say Bono?
Yes, Bono.
Why did he say that?
He said he's not a religious person, but he's a very spiritual person.
But when did he say that?
Oh, boy, it must have been somewhere between The Unforgettable Fire and The Joshua Tree.
That's really interesting.
Sure, I heard it about 5 years ago.
That's interesting. Okay.
But anyway, when you sit down to write, is there a different mindset that changes from Ziggy Stardust to David Bowie to Tin Machine? I mean, have you been writing?
Yes.
Have you been writing any lyrics?
I was writing very strictly for a character for Ziggy Stardust. I mean, that was definitely a sort of an undertaking to create somebody. I mean, there was no doubt about it. That wasn't this is me expressing myself, which I think probably, well, I know for sure that this is what the work that I've been doing with Tin Machine is. I mean, there's no angles on it. Everything that you hear is an approximation of what my particular emotional thing was at the time of writing.
Now, when you write songs now, you're writing specifically for Tin Machine. You haven't written anything in the last year or two that is...
That's right.
A Bowie song?
Absolutely, for them. And I really don't feel any need to write for on a solo basis.
Sorry. right. So this thing is...
But that doesn't, that obviously doesn't rule out my wanting to in the future.
So this thing is sort of temporary but permanent, or...?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I can quite see the day coming when I would have both be doing solo work and working within the context of Tin Machine as well.
So how successful do you expect this band to become?
I don't think we have any expectations whatsoever.
So that's the beauty of the whole thing.
Foolish. Foolhardy.
Right.
I think you've got to thoroughly enjoy the day in hand, otherwise you're devoting energies and to the false illusion of, you know, past and future.
Last question here, Shopping for Girls. Where did the inspiration? I know it came from Sarah's story, but
yes, actually, yeah.
Why write a song about it?
That's quite cyclic. I guess because we'd all experienced the same thing. I don't know. I think it was a pretty... I mean, it was a tough conversation that we had over a dinner one night, you know, because we'd all sort of explored that part of the world and seen very much the same thing happening throughout. And I guess it got to the point where one of us probably said, you know, I mean, maybe some, you know, really, somebody should really kind of, you know, say something about that.
Yeah, I remember seeing a segment on 60 Minutes about 5 years ago about that.
Yeah.
About how they advertise in the American magazines.
Oh, yes, I know. It's quite extraordinary. And you get literally plane loads of executive businessmen who go off on their sprees for a weekend, you know.
That's unbelievable.
Oh, it is. It's quite incredible. Well, Reeves had the very unsavory job of hiring the children so that he could get them out of the brothel so that they could be interviewed by Sarah. So it was all pretty heavy stuff.
They all had horror stories to tell?
Oh, yeah. But he can tell you himself.
Well, he'll be calling me very soon, so I'll let you...
Not only that, I'm just going to put him straight on to you.
Oh, you are.
He's zipping up a kit bag at the moment. He's packing. This is called, in our business, packing.
Packing.
This is called leaving this hotel, but we haven't played yet. Oh, he's ready, you see. This man is ready to go.
Thank you, and
this man can't wait to get out of Newcastle.
I hope to see you in Washington next week.
Fantastic.
And,
yeah, it's going to be really exciting. We're very, very excited about coming back to America.
Teresa said she's going to get you to say hello to me. Is that a problem?
No, absolutely not.
No, that'd be great.
No, I'd be disillusioned and quite distraught if you didn't come.
I'll come now.
Okay, well, all right. turn up if you like.
You'd miss me a little.
Here's Reeves.
Thanks, David.
Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
Bye-bye.